The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
A decent interest rate on a cash ISA and no long transfer delays. We tell you where you don't have to queue. A crunch month for house prices. We tell you the not so bad news. And new smartphone apps that can help you plan your pensions and investments. We tell you if they are of use to the least technologically savvy among you. All this to come in this week's FT Money Show. I'm Matthew Vincent, and I'll be giving you the lowdown on all of these money matters in downloadable form with my colleagues from FT Money, Steve Lodge.
Hello.
And Tanya Poley.
Hi.
And our special studio guest, Ed Mead, from the London-based estate agency Douglas & Gordon.
Hello there.
So let's start with the money news. Hard-pressed savers have had some long-awaited good news as Halifax has announced a much better rate on its easy access cash ISAs and a better deal for customers when transferring their cash ISAs. From now on, Halifax's Cash ISA Direct Reward will pay a market-leading 2.8% for 12 months, which increases to 3% for customers who hold their main current account with Halifax. What's more, customers will earn this interest rate from the day their completed application is received, and they are guaranteed to get the rate they applied for during the transfer process. Steve, now after lots of complaints and problems with ISA transfers, this sounds like a long-awaited improvement to the process.
Yes, Matthew, it certainly should be. I mean, it's highly unusual to pay interest from the day the application is received because, of course, they haven't had the funds yet, which could take anything up to weeks beyond that. So in theory, people could end up earning interest from both their old provider and from Halifax if they're switching to Halifax. But it also addresses another issue as well that we've heard lots of complaints about how long transfers can take, and the Office of Fair Trading did some research earlier this year which found a quarter took more than 30 working days despite a current limit of 23 working days. But in addition to that, there can be an interest gap where you lose interest of up to 5 days in the middle, and that's because, as we know, when we transfer money, one bank likes to stop paying interest before the other one likes to pay it because they want to clear the funds and so on. So it does address that point as well. So in effect, people are getting a sort of marginal increase in their interest and also hopefully getting speedier transfers.
Now, the sort of cynic in me asked the question, why is Halifax doing this? No one else, as far as I can tell, is offering this kind of deal.
No one, as far as we're aware, is offering anything quite so attractive. I mean, of course, it is pretty marginal. Say they pay another 3 extra days, that's equivalent to another 0.01% on top of whatever rate they're paying, i.e. not very much for that particular year. They're attempting to steal a march on changes that the OFT, the competition watchdog, is bringing in from the end of this year. The OFT has agreed with the industry that transfers in future from the end of this year should only take 15 working days, no longer than that. And that lost interest period should be no more than 2 days. And frankly, the OFT would like to see brought down to there being no gap at all. Well, we'll see, because, that doesn't happen with other savings accounts, for example. But it's also sort of put a marker, drawn a line in the sand as well, that if the industry doesn't buck up its ideas, and there does seem to be some pretty appalling admin on ICE transfers, which I imagine many listeners themselves will have experienced, then it's said that the FSA should look at this issue from a more regulatory point of view and possibly looking at fining people or forcing changes, maybe next year.
And until these guidelines come into force, what are your sort of top tips for transferring your ISA money?
Well, I mean, obviously, if you can be bothered, dare I say it, to transfer. I mean, much of the problem here is that people can't be bothered to transfer. They think all rates are the same, all rates are low. I mean, there is a big difference between the worst rates, which can be as low as 0.1%, and the best rates, which for instant access can be about 3% and up to about 4.5% for fixed rates. But if people want to sort of fast track option, they should definitely consider transferring internally, if you like. So if you're with the Halifax, you mentioned a deal there, 2.8%, that's the best buy, accepts all transfers, 3% if you've got a current account. The Halifax also has as many as 1 million savers, ISA savers, the Halifax being the biggest ISA provider, that are earning 0.5 or less at the moment. Now, strangely enough, it's not going around knocking on everyone's doors saying we must transfer you in, or indeed automatically transferring them in. So you do need to do something yourself. You do need to be a bit proactive. But all those people could instantly increase their rates by more than 2 percentage points with no effect on the access they had on their money, because the money will be still instant access. So people should look at that. Similarly with Santander, similarly with Nationwide, all the big players typically allow transfers into, if you like, their shiny new products at the front of the shop window.
Yep, no hassle, no transfer delay. It sounds like the way to go. Steve, thanks very much indeed for that. And for details of those Halifax Cash ISA rates and indeed the best rates from other banks and building societies, look out for Steve's article in the money section of this weekend's FT and online at ft.com/money. Still to come on the show, pension planning. There's an app for that. But do you really want to plan your retirement on a mobile phone? First, though, the housing market. A couple of months ago, an FT journalist wrote that September will be crunch time for the housing market, as property analysts would be looking to post-summer activity to determine whether the recent slowdown was temporary or the start of a second downturn. That FT journalist was our very own Tanya Poley. So she has been poring over this week's data from Nationwide Building Society, the Bank of England and the Land Registry with great interest. So, Tanya, I guess the question is, has it come to the crunch?
Well, I've been speaking to quite a lot of agents this week, and the general feedback has been that, I mean, they're slightly more optimistic, or perhaps I should say slightly less bearish. I mean, we're not seeing them jumping up and down on chairs and happiness. But there was a sense that at the beginning of September, phone calls were quite quiet, and we've kind of seen perhaps slightly, like, sort of, more kind of phone calls coming in towards the end of September. I've actually got Ed here, and I know that Ed, actually, he was quoted in an FT article at the beginning of September saying that he was quite concerned about sort of the next coming months, and he was quite bearish. Has that changed now that we've seen the end of the month?
Well, it has a bit, I have to say. I mean, whether I quite come into the less bearish or more optimistic camp is difficult to say. But I think you need to set the context for the year. Bear in mind, it's been a very odd year for the property market, because traditionally the spring market's good. That was ruined by the election. The summer market was really ruined by the budget. Mm-hmm. So it's been a very odd year. There are an awful lot of people who've been waiting and waiting and waiting. And I think perhaps the waiting might just be coming to an end. We are seeing some activity, but it's very low levels. As I said to you, Tanya, a little bit earlier, I'm more worried about volumes than I am about values. I think the volumes in the market are very, very low and give a real cause for concern.
Have we seen a volumes increase, like, since August? Or, I mean, what's the comparison from last month and the year
well,
before?
I mean, the trouble, what's happening at the moment is, I mean, my company, Douglas & Gordon, we have a lot of offices in London, so we give a pretty good snapshot of what's happening in London. We've got about 30% more property than we had in August and about 20% fewer buyers. Mm-hmm. So the problem is, it's the buyers who are finding life a little bit tough, and they're not around in any great numbers. Added to which, of course, you tend to get a lot of foreigners in London looking, yep. And they really have vanished. But the supply increase hasn't been as bad as we feared, so perhaps the outlook for values isn't as bad as we might have feared. The problem is that the buyers are disappearing, and that's where volumes are suffering.
Is there still a sense that the sellers that are there aren't actually really sort of pricing very realistically at the moment?
Well, the issue with volumes has created an issue with the estate agents that means that there are an awful lot of agents that are not going to go out of business. Mm-hmm. I mean, volumes are now less than a third of what they were 10 years ago, really? And about half what they were 3 years ago. Yeah. Now, 3 years ago, you didn't see a lot of agents close, but you saw them going from 5 fully-fledged salespeople to sort of one man and a dog, mm-hmm. and they've hung on and hung on and hung on. And a lot of these people are now going to be closing their doors because volumes are so low. So those that are there are fighting for business, which means they're, I'm afraid, overvaluing a lot of the stock that's there, giving sellers unrealistic expectations of what they of what they've got. And that's creating real issues because, of course, you then get an overhang of supply which sits there and sits there and sits there. And these people look as if they're beginning to get realistic about the prices. They're beginning to come down a little bit, the asking prices.
Ed, you said estate agents fighting for stock. Presumably that means you're reducing your prices as well rather than letting the dog go.
Well, when you say reducing our prices, do you mean reducing our
your
fees?
Your commission, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely become an issue. I mean, fees are an obvious part. You know, it's a free market. People can shop around. The issue's been, though, Steve, that a lot of people who've perhaps employed the wrong agent at the lowest fee at a silly price are now realising what they need is a proper agent and they're prepared to pay to get the job done. Now, that's not completely true. They're not paying the same rates as they were a few years back. And
so
it is
what
still
might people be paying in London now, then?
Well, I mean, traditionally, in the very centre of London, fees used to be between sort of 2-2.5% if you wanted to get one agent doing it. I mean, the costs, people scoff, but the costs of running an agency in central London are very much higher than they are outside the centre of London. Those fees can now be definitely negotiated down at 2% and below. If you're in the areas which you were referring to earlier, I think your very own, W14, this sort of area,
yep.
you can definitely get, you know, low ones, 1.5% is certainly not unreasonable. But at the end of the day, you've got to bear in mind that the average prices in central London are £500,000-£600,000. If you're talking about the odd quarter of a percent, you know, do you want to get your house sold by a good agent or do you want someone that's charging you a low fee?
I don't want to pay tens of thousands of pounds to sell my property. That's what I don't want to do.
Who does? Unfortunately, we are a necessary part of life. And dare I say, we provide a socially useful service.
So, Ed, to sum it up, I mean, what do you think the outlook for the next few months and, say, the coming year is going to be?
Well, I think the fact that the supply overhang isn't as bad as we feared it would be, and the fact that the spreads that the banks are now offering on their mortgage rates are as good as they've ever been. I mean, you've got HSBC offering, you know, a 99% booking fee and 2.19%. And the outlook for interest rates seems to be that they're going to stay pretty low for quite a long time.
Yeah.
I think that's tempting a lot of people who are perhaps a little bit nervous about interest rates back into the market sooner. I suspect the run-up to Christmas may be a little better than we feared. Who knows what happens beyond that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you indeed, Ed. And for an analysis of which parts of the housing market are looking a little bit more resilient than others, you can read Tanya's feature in the FT Money section this weekend or go onto our website at ft.com/money. And finally today, smartphone apps. This week, Britain's biggest life insurance and pension company, Aviva, launched a new app for the Apple iPhone to make pensions planning simpler and more accessible, or so it said. And it's not the first to put financial planning tools onto a mobile phone. Fidelity has a fund data app, and more than 600 independent financial advisors now offer portfolio monitoring via a smartphone app. But do they really make investing any easier, or are they just a gimmick? Well, to test them out, we put them into the hands of our most and least tech-savvy journalists, who just happen to be, respectively, Tanya and Steve. Tanya, if I start with you, you've tested a whole load of these apps this week. Tell us about the best and the worst.
I think it does vary quite a bit. I mean, in terms of how useful some of these apps are, I mean, there's still a long way to go, I think. I think this is kind of the start of kind of the smartphone apps and what they can provide users, especially in terms of managing their personal finances. I did particularly like this app from True Potential, which is an IFA services provider. And they, like you said, they've got about 650 IFA firms signed up to them, which is about 650,000 private clients. And this app actually does let you monitor your portfolio online, well, through your phone, and you can see kind of up to date sort of valuations, and it just kind of gives quite a quick kind of overview of how much you're worth at the moment. And I think that's quite nice, because I don't know of any other apps that actually kind of give you that kind of instant knowledge of your portfolio. And it also has this kind of messaging system where you can send messages straight to your IFA over this kind of encrypted platform. Which is kind of, it's just kind of this nice element of easiness and quickness. And if you just got a quick query on a certain fund or certain investment, you can just sort of snap it over to them quite quickly. I think the take up of that is going to be, it will take quite a while. I'm not sure how high percentage of actually the clients are actually using this that so far. But I think as more and more IFA firms realise this is something quite beneficial, I think we're going to see a lot more like people using it, and it's going to come a lot more mainstream, really.
And what about the sort of property and mortgage sector? Property finding apps have been out there for a while.
Yeah.
What about mortgage finder apps? Are there such a thing?
No, we've got a couple of mortgage brokers that have launched a certain apps that kind of give mortgage calculators and tools like that, so you can kind of find out instantly like how much you can borrow or how much your kind of monthly payments are going to be, which I think is probably quite useful if you're sort of going around looking at properties and you kind of want to perhaps it's slightly more expensive than you were initially, you know, thinking that you'd go for, just to find out whether you could afford it or not. So they're quite cool. I mean, London Country has one that they launched a couple months ago, I think, and they've also got a kind of list of the best buy mortgages as well, so you can kind of see like list of current rates and stuff. But obviously you still have to go to them to sort of seek advice and stuff like that, so they're quite useful just kind of, you know, to play around and see what exactly you can borrow.
Now, Steve, you're not an iPhone user, and I don't wish to preempt your testing because I know that you're about to embark upon this, but how do you feel about these apps? Do you reckon that they have any value?
Well, Matthew, I mean, won't surprise you to hear that I'm not entirely convinced at the moment. As you rightly say, I'm still struggling to get into the iPhone, so I'm hoping Tanya will find the on and off button for me shortly after our conversation. But I would raise some issues. I mean, I wonder, I mean, we've got Ed here, if I was buying a property, I would serious about a particular area, I would probably register with the local agents, really get to know them, find out who are the really top agents there, because they're always first rank, second rank, and if you like, complete chances. And then I'd rely on them, and I'd rely on websites as well. I'm not sure I'd really be wandering around the street suddenly going, oh, there's a property, I wonder how much that is, and so on. I would expect a good agent to be giving me that information and or register with one of these websites where presumably you can get email alerts and so on. Similarly with my mortgage as well. I'm not sure, you know, I'd like to think I actually knew what my budget was before I wandered round. But a wider point, I mean, I don't think the banking industry is there yet on transactions with apps, I'm told. No. But I do wonder, when it does get there, if you like, will there be issues with security, connectivity? You know, these are wireless applications, aren't they? And people will know that their mobile phone doesn't always even work in London. And I wonder as well whether we're going to see a sort of a renewed Betamax VHS debate. Remember that, where you get the wrong technology. So if Tanya convinces me over our cheese sandwich lunch today to get one of these iPhone things, how do I know by Christmas I'm going to be... have been sold a pup, the oldest technology, and I should be getting one of these, whatever you've got, a BlackBerry or something, and I understand they have apps as well.
They do.
So
yes.
How do I know which apps are best, and how do I know which technology is going to be cutting edge? So I think I'm tempted to wait and see. And the final point I would say is, remember WAP banking? You and me remember that because we're old enough. Tanya's so young and sort of still got that curiosity of youth about her. But WAP banking, of course, was mobile phone banking. It didn't work.
That's because the technology wasn't there to support.
And you'd
it.
Know why.
Exactly. Well,
we have actually seen quite an increase in. There was research this week which showed that apparently 3 million Britons are already using mobile phone banking.
Maybe the technology does work now.
I think, and they're saying that actually mobile banking users via their smartphone are actually accessing their accounts far more frequently than people who use internet banking.
Well, let's see if it turns into 3,000,001 later later today. And if you'd like to know how Steve gets on with his testing of the iPhone apps, and if you'd like to read Tanya's reviews of them as well, you can in the money section of this weekend's FT. So, yes, I look forward to that in particular. But that's all for this week's FT Money Show. Remember that you will find weekday news updates and all of today's stories on our website, ft.com/money. And if you have a question that you'd like us to answer about any aspect of your finances, just email us and we'll try and get a financial guru to address your question. Send your questions into the email address money@ft.com. Next week we'll bring you another financial lowdown in downloadable form, but until then, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Tanya, Steve and Ed Mead from estate agents Douglas and Gordon.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.